Raise your hands if you remember the Novichok incident in Salisbury. Raise your hands if you were believing the official story on this. Did it make sense to you? Well, there's a lot of questions, and Tim is probably, I would say, the foremost expert on this topic that you could find. I don't think anybody has done the level of exhaustive research, what we might call opposition research, although he's just digging for the truth on this subject. And it has huge geopolitical implications. People don't realize what happened then, and the expulsion of Russian diplomats, the levying of sanctions. So all of these incidents, these WMD incidents, or these strange anomalies, assassinations and so forth, always have policy attached to them on the end, which is something that we like to look at. But I'm going to hand it over to Tim Norman. Then we're joined by Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan and a veteran, career foreign office veteran. And so we'll start with Tim, and he's going to give a brief presentation and just kind of put you in the frame of what happened, and then point to a couple of key anomalies. And there's so many. Tim's only showing us a couple. But I do believe he is working on a sort of tome on this topic, which hopefully will be out soon. But I'm going to hand it over to Tim Norman, independent researcher and journalist as well. So thank you guys for coming. This should be interesting. Tim.
Thanks, Patrick. Just like to say thank you to Glenn and everyone involved that's producing the Rebel Tent. It's been an amazing lineup and an amazing thing the Rebel Tent is. That's thanks from me, and it's thanks from my wife and children down there as well, because we've had a wonderful time here at Beautiful Days, and so thanks to everyone. And also I'd like to say it's thanks to Glenn and the Rebel Tent. I'm sharing the platform with two people whose work I've admired for a very, very long time. I've watched Patrick on UK Column News for years, and anybody watch UK Column? I recommend, humbly recommend, that you tune in. It's three times a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday, midday on ukcolumn.org, and Patrick's a regular host there, and I guarantee you'll get more truth and real journalism in an hour UK Column News and you'll get from a year from BBC News, I can promise you that. Patrick has his own platform, 21st Century Wire. That's always worth a watch, especially on the Sunday. And he pops up all over the internet just before we came to Beautiful Days. He was on a podcast called Dialogue Works. That's a really important geopolitical podcast that's trying to bring a bit of sanity and peace to the world. And I've never seen anyone that can kind of draw the amount of geopolitical analysis and synthesize it in a simple way for people to understand in the way that Patrick can do. So, yeah, amazing, amazing. And as for Craig, I honestly think Craig Murray is one of the most important journalists working in the English language today. I mean, that's just one string to his bow, of course, but just the reporting alone on, for example, the Assange extradition case, extraordinary effort, an incredible, like a Herculean task that he undertook. A much greater journalist than me called him the greatest truth teller of our time, and I really don't think he was wrong. That would be Peter Oborne who said that. So this is someone whose journalism has been such a thorn in the side of the British establishment. They trumped up. They 8-month prison sentence was handed down to Craig because of his reporting on totally trumped up charges. And it's just the lucidity of his writing that I think is what makes it such a problem for the establishment. A great humanity and humour that he brings to his writing as well that makes it tremendously accessible. The establishment was so scared of Craig that after he blew the whistle on Uzbekistan torturing, boiling people alive, in fact, they produced a series of television programmes trying to make it into a comedy, just trying to make Craig's whistleblowing into some sort of a bit of a joke. I mean, that is the level of fear that the establishment has for Craig Murray. It really is amazing to be up on this platform with him. So, anyway, we're here to talk about the so-called Skripal Novichok poisoning back in 2018, and both Patrick and Craig published articles about expressing, shall we say, scepticism. About what the mainstream media and the then-government of Theresa May was claiming happened in Salisbury. It's a narrative that's been maintained to this day by the current Starmer regime. In fact, Craig published a series of articles, and there's one in particular called Pure, 10 Points I Just Can't Believe About the Official Skripal Narrative, which remains, for me, the most relevant article about the so-called Skripal poisonings, and maybe he can talk about that. The point about Pure is extremely important. So I don't want to hog the stage. I really want to hear Craig and Patrick's views about this. But at the end of last year, the government finally held a public inquiry into what supposedly happened. It's technically still ongoing, this public inquiry. It hasn't published its final report. I published a few articles about that, and I did a presentation last week in London. It went on for an hour, so I've tried to cut it down to just sort of 5 or 10 minutes. Just going to focus on like one particularly absurd little detail, and there are so many absurd details in this story. It's almost impossible It's properly mad. This really is a mad story when you get into it. It's like, put your underpants on your head, stick pencils up your nose and go wibble level of mad. It's that mad. It's almost impossible to explain. But I'm going to try just by focusing on this one factor, and it's this. So I'll do the short, super short version of the official narrative. It's this. President Putin sent two assassins from the GRU secret service called Boshirov and Petrov to kill a retired Russian double agent called Sergei Skripal, who was living in Salisbury, and they were using this poison called Novichok, this deadly nerve agent. And the weapon they used was a small bottle containing an incredibly deadly nerve agent, as I said, and the bottle was disguised as a perfume bottle. And after they used it, they dumped it in a bin in Salisbury. So then this man, who's called Charlie Rowley, found a bottle in the bin and he gave it to his girlfriend, Dawn Sturgis. So Dawn sprayed herself with deadly nerve agent from the bottle and she died. Right. So that doesn't sound completely mad, right? It doesn't sound completely beyond the bounds of possibility, does it really? So here's the absurd detail that we're going to focus on, just this one. Charlie Rowley insisted that the bottle he found was boxed and sealed in plastic, and it was in two parts with a dispenser cap separate from the bottle. So this is just one question that the public inquiry into Dawn's death needs to answer. If the bottle of Novichok was used to poison Sergei Skripal, how could it be found later boxed and sealed in plastic as if it was new? So here we are. I'm going to go for this quick presentation of slides. Just remember, this is the official narrative that I'm giving to you right here. This is not something I made up. This is what we are supposed to believe is actually happened. Okay. So. Ooh. So, as I said, on 4th of March 2018, two Russian assassins acting on the orders of Vladimir Putin and armed with a fake perfume bottle that contained an unbelievably deadly nerve agent called Novichok tried and failed to kill a retired Russian double agent called Sergei Skripal, who by that time had been living under his own name in the English city of Salisbury for 8 years. The two assassins, there they are, flew from Moscow into the UK on passports that they had used before. They'd stayed in a London hotel that they'd stayed in before. And they travelled to Salisbury by train using their fake bottle to spray unbelievably deadly nerve agent onto the front door handle of Scrifell's home. Both Sergei and his daughter Yulia, so that's actually where that's supposed to be, where it was. Both Sergei and his daughter Yulia, who was visiting him from Moscow at the time, were inside the house and touched the nerve agent as they left shortly after lunchtime to drive into Salisbury city centre. Luckily, there's Salisbury city centre. Luckily, neither of them were killed. Sergei and Yulia, now contaminated, parked at a supermarket car park, fed ducks on the River Avon with some local boys, went for a drink at a pub. Look at that, touching that with a deadly nerve agent. And then they sat on a public bench. Went for a meal at a city's restaurant. And then they sat on a public bench a couple of hours later and they passed out. So they were taken to Salisbury Hospital, where they were apparently diagnosed as being exposed to an opiate. They both recovered. And apart from a short statement from Yulia, they were never heard of again. So, no shoppers, ducks, boys, pub workers, restaurant workers, members of the public, police, paramedics, or doctors were cross-contaminated by unbelievably deadly Novichok after touching the Skrifels or items that they would have touched before they collapsed. That's an actual CCTV that was released to the inquiry of them passed out on the bench in Salisbury. So meanwhile, after spraying Skrifel's front door with unbelievably deadly Novichok, the two Russian assassins, there they are, also decided to go into Salisbury city centre, where they did a bit of window shopping, showing some particular interest in antique stamps and coins. Have a look at Boshrov. That's a nice-looking stamp. Do you not think we should be making getaway? No. Maybe it's open. It wasn't open because it's a Sunday, of course. Anyway, then they went to a public toilet together and they took apart their fake perfume bottle and put it into a gift box, which they wrapped in plastic and sealed up using a portable heat sealer. Oh, no, I'm not clicking. Oh, there you go, there's your portable heat sealer. And then they dropped their carefully sealed package in a bin and they flew back to Moscow. So, the British knew almost immediately that it was a Russian operation that had been ordered by President Putin because the nerve agent had a Russian-sounding name. And all their allies agreed with them. And so they expelled hundreds of diplomats from embassies across Europe and the USA. The UK also thought about boycotting the World Cup. But ultimately, the England team did take part, where they made it to the semi-finals. And they were beaten 2-1 by Croatia in extra time. More than 4 months after the events in Salisbury, the fake perfume bottle that the assassins had dumped turned up 8 miles away in the kitchen of a flat in Amesbury. The occupant of the flat was an alcoholic and a heroin addict who couldn't remember finding the bottle.
It is very vague as to where I found it, as to when I found it. I believe it may have been in the Salisbury area, possibly Amesbury. I'm not sure.
But the media reported he found it in a bin.
He may have fished the sealed package from a bin while looking for discarded treasures, as he calls them.
It's possible that it may have been somewhere like here.
It's a possibility that I may have found it here, because...
He did remember cutting open the plastic packaging and putting the pump dispenser on the bottle, spilling a large amount of unbelievably deadly nerve agent on his hands as he did so.
So he had to remove the bottle from the cellophane wrapper, put the pump dispenser on the bottle, and it poured. I ended up tipping some of my hands, but I...
He said the liquid didn't smell of anything much.
Oily substance with very little odour. Mm. They were on tests on it.
He gave it to his girlfriend anyway, who sprayed herself with it and died. She was revived by paramedics and taken to Salisbury District Hospital, but he stayed in Amesbury. He poured Novichok on his hands at this point. He stayed in Amesbury, where he went to a chemist and to get some methadone, and then to a barbecue at a local Baptist church before going back to his flat, where he collapsed. He was also taken to hospital, where he was unconscious for a few days, during which time the decision was taken to turn off his girlfriend's life support. 2 days after that, he woke up. His girlfriend's family were unhappy with the coroner's inquest into the cause of her death and used the courts to force the UK government to set up a public inquiry. The UK government dragged its heels for 6 years, but eventually held an inquiry at the end of last year. The final report hasn't been published yet, but the inquiry confirmed everything that I've just said is completely true, especially the part about Russian assassins using a portable heat sealer in a public toilet to seal their fake perfume bottle in plastic before dumping it. So this is Keith Asman, head of the forensics for the Police Counter-Terrorism Unit, giving testimony to the inquiry. Have a look at the faces of the two lawyers in the background as he speaks. He's off camera.
The reality is, I believe that they used it, I believe they dismantled it, I believe they placed it into the plastic packaging and then using a portable heat sealer sealed some of the component parts of the device into plastic packaging.
The Deputy Chief of MI5, who was responsible for handling the UK's response to the Salisbury affair, Ken McCollum, was promoted to Director General. So this is the story of the Salisbury nerve agent perfume bottle, brought to you by the media, who told you the hard truth about the third tower, which collapsed on 9/11. WMD in Iraq. Moderate rebels in Syria. And Joe Biden's cognitive decline.
Thank you, Tim. Now, what you've just seen, just remember, this is the basis for what the current Prime Minister is saying. Russia is attacking us on our streets with weapons of mass destruction. That provides the foreign policy basis for a de facto state of war with Russia. And this is one of the key points, the key bolts that holds that position into place. And to me, it's very shaky based on what Tim has shown, but it goes a lot deeper than that. I want to hand this over to Craig now. I think you can grab that microphone just below you, Craig.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name's Craig Murray. I'm a former British ambassador. I'm a journalist nowadays and an activist. I speak, well, when I was in the Foreign Office, I used to speak fluent Russian. I've lived in St. Petersburg. I was ambassador in Tashkent, a former Soviet country, and actually the place where, not Tashkent, but Uzbekistan, the country, a place where the Russian nerve agents were developed. And I've actually been to the laboratories at Nukus, which were decommissioned by the Americans. Everything that was inside those laboratories was taken to the United States of America. All the equipment that was used for synthesizing Russian nerve agents was taken to the USA. I visited it a couple of years after that had been done. And it's also worth remembering that within those labs, when they were synthesizing nerve agents, were employed people from all over the Soviet Union, including actually the majority of scientists in those labs were Ukrainian. I just throw that out as an interesting fact for you to know. And I want you to consider this against the background of the Russophobia to which we are being exposed. Russia has never had, ever in its history, a plan to invade the United Kingdom. It just hasn't. That's simply a fact. Russia is currently engaged in a war with Ukraine because Russia does want to take part the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine. And you may view that as right, or you may view it as wrong. It's in, you know, opinions can reasonably differ, I believe, on that. You may view NATO expansion as a good thing or a bad thing. Opinions can differ on that. But what opinions cannot differ on is that Russia has no plan to occupy or invade the United Kingdom. And this massive Russophobia to which we are being subjected, which is being used to pump up the arms industry and put money into the weapons manufacturers at a time when we can't afford to pay heating allowance to old people. You've got to look at what's the motive behind that. And the Salisbury so-called Novichok event played a massive part in ramping up Russophobia in the UK, and still does. And I'd like to say, racism against Russians is the permissible racism. You can say anything as horrible as you like about Russians and people don't call you out for it. This is wrong. Russia is a country with fantastic history and fantastic culture. It gave the world... thousands of people every day. Sorry?
Bombing the hell out of Ukraine.
They are bombing Ukraine. They have killed...
We can handle that in the Q&A. If you just hold that for after, we're done with the presentation. Thanks.
Russia has a substantial intelligence agency. And I think as we go through this, I want people to remember Dawn Sturgis and remember that she died of what we don't know. But I don't want to disrespect her or her death in any way. And I don't want the fact that I treat some of the story with the levity it deserves to make you think I disrespect Dawn Sturgis. I don't in any way. I'm terribly sorry for her tragic death. But Russia has an extremely effective intelligence agency with which I've locked horns personally in the past. And when I was a British ambassador and throughout my 22-year diplomatic career, I worked very closely, literally next door to MI6, often in offices throughout the world. The Russians are very efficient. We are asked to believe that two GRU agents from Russian military intelligence who are highly qualified, highly experienced GRU agents came here in order to assassinate Sergei Skripal and failed to assassinate him. We are asked to believe, and this is the official story, that they came here with what is officially, according to the UK government, the deadliest substance in the entire world, and which is created when organophosphate nerve agents, because that's all Novichok is, it's not a single substance, it's a class of nerve agents designed to be able to be created locally using local ingredients, using easily available ingredients. But it's when it's created in labs, which has been done around the world in many places. When organophosphate nerve agents have been created around the world, people wear the heaviest of protective clothing because a spot on your arm can kill you. And yet, we are asked to believe that these people came here with no protective equipment whatsoever. You've seen them walking through the streets of Salisbury, and that from a spray, they sprayed the underside of a door handle with something which, if it gets on you, will kill you, while not wearing protective equipment. We're also asked to believe, and this again is the official story, that the night before they did this, they stayed in a cheap hotel in London where they drank a bottle of vodka and had a prostitute until 4:30 a.m. Now, of course, all of us know that if you're going to handle the world's most deadly nerve agent, you're going to drink a bottle of vodka the night before you do it, aren't you? I mean, absolutely what you would do in preparation. And remember, these are people from a very professional intelligence agency. We're then asked to believe, and this is astonishing, we are asked to believe that the Skripals got the nerve agent on their skin, then went around Salisbury, went to a pub, had alcohol, was still feeling well enough. They can't have been feeling ill at all because they went to a restaurant and had a meal with dessert and wine. Now, if you're feeling queasy, that's not something you do. And then suddenly, hours after they touched the Novichok, I think 7 hours after they touched the Novichok, they both instantaneously, simultaneously, collapsed on a bench at the same moment, despite the fact they touched the Novichok 7 hours earlier, so neither of them could call for help because they both collapsed absolutely simultaneously. Now, that's simply impossible. They were of different ages. They were of different genders. They were of different weights. They were of different health conditions. There is no way they would both collapse at the same time. But what happens next? They collapse on the bench, and along comes the first person to find them on the bench, who, by coincidence, just happened to be the chief nurse of the British Army. Absolutely true. I'm not making that up. The person who found them on the bench was, by chance, the chief nurse of the British Army. Now, the odds on that happening are the same as the odds on your vacuum cleaner breaking down just as James Dyson knocks on your door to ask for directions. It's bollocks. It's complete bollocks. They think we are stupid. And one good thing, the only good thing to come out of the terrible disaster of the genocide in Gaza, is that people realise now that your government lies to you all the time and the BBC lie to you all the time. And if you don't believe them on one thing, if you don't believe them on Gaza, and you shouldn't, why would you believe them on Salisbury? Because so much of it is entirely unbelievable. Now, they don't die. And the assassins, as you say, this is a very professional intelligence agency, right? Now, you are spraying a supposedly instantaneously acting, although it didn't, poison on the door handle in order to kill somebody. And you're in Salisbury. And you haven't been in disguise. You haven't been hiding yourself. You've been wandering around the streets. And you've done this in broad daylight on a residential estate where anyone could have seen you. So what is your getaway plan? You go into town, you do some window shopping, and then you get on a train on a Sunday. We all know what the Sunday train service is like. Surely, if the Russians had actually done this, they would have had an immediate, fast getaway out of Salisbury lined out. The notion that they did this, then wandered around looking in shops, and then got on a Sunday railway train in order to make their escape, it's just not tradecraft. It's just not. I can tell you, somebody who has a certain amount of tradecraft, it's not. They would not have done that any more than they would have got completely pissed on vodka hours before making a dangerous assassination attempt. And this idea that they then desealed the perfume bottle in order to put it in the bin, why? Why would you reseal it? What would be the point? Well, think of it. Think of a good reason to actually carry a portable heat sealer, and which there's no evidence they were carrying, and then seal up neatly the perfume bottle and leave it somewhere. They weren't intending... They were apparently supposed to be killing Sergei Skripal. They weren't intending to randomly kill people on the streets of Salisbury. Well, why would you do that? It's obvious nonsense. It's just nonsense. Let me give you another thing, which is nonsense. The police searched what it was actually in one of the slides we saw. It was actually in one of the newspaper slides we saw there. After the death of Dawn Sturgis, the police searched Charlie Rowley's flat. A huge team of police searched Charlie Rowley's flat. They were looking for a file containing Novichok. They searched for 5 days and found nothing. And on the fifth day, they found a perfume bottle sitting on the kitchen counter. You're a team of policemen. You're in this house. You are looking for a file of liquid. And there's a perfume bottle sitting on the kitchen counter, and it takes you 5 days to find it. Now, because the inquiry, frankly, was a farce, there was no real representation of people to question the official narrative, very much wasn't actually raised. But this point was raised. This point was actually made at the public inquiry. The police were asked why it took them 5 days to find this bottle of Novichok on the Christmas on the counter. And I swear to you, this is true. The reply at the public inquiry was, it took us 5 days to find it because it was behind the washing up. I've actually got a load of Palestine Action stuff in my house. I'm going to go home and stick it behind the washing up because the police will never, ever, never find it there. It's bollocks. It's absolute bollocks. You are being sold a lie, and you are being sold a lie to prepare you for massive injections of your money into the weapons industry to demonize Russia. It's worse than the time of the Cold War. The Americans have sent 3 lots of new nuclear weapons into Lakenheath in the last month, and nobody has even bothered to comment on it. We are being put on a militaristic footing. Keir Starmer's talking of economic growth coming from increasing the funding of the military industry. And it's all based on stories which are simply untrue. And the nonsense behind so much of the story, the idea that these top assassins couldn't kill these people, the idea that they both simultaneously got ill 7 hours after touching the Novichok, the idea that the chief nurse of the British Army found them, the idea it took the police 5 days to find the perfume bottle on the kitchen counter. These are only some of them. As Tim so kindly said, there's an article I've written called Pure, 10 Points I Don't Believe. Millions and millions of people have read it. It's very easy to Google and find. In which I list 10 of these points are things which are simply and utterly unbelievable. I'll give you another one. Nick Bailey, his name was, who unfortunately got ill, allegedly through Novichok. He supposedly got nerve agent on the light switches and the door handles internally all over his home. All over his home. And when this was announced, It was asked why his family, who had continued to live in the home for 2 days, hadn't got any on their hands when they touched light switches or door handles. And the Home Office spokesman replied, and this is the official line, it was a miracle. You have to believe in miracles to believe the official story. We are subject to brainwashing. This is actually probably the worst, most laughable brainwashing attempt I've ever seen. And it only succeeds because of the unanimous control of our state and billionaire-owned media who pump out this nonsense to you. I hope that's given you food for thought. I'd be very happy to take questions and to have further discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt. Now, Nat, we'll go to questions in a moment. I want to get a dialogue with Craig and Tim on this, but there's a natural temptation after seeing what you've just seen in a story like this to immediately want to ask, well, what do you think did happen? You want to posit what you might call a conspiracy theory, a real conspiracy theory, to answer this void of a plausible explanation of what you're looking at. And I think the important thing here, and this is why I like Tim's work and this type of journalism, is that when someone's making a positive claim, like the government, for instance, that this happened and that happened from an inquiry or an inquest, the burden of proof is on the person making the positive claim. Okay, they have to prove it. You don't have to come up with a plausible replacement conspiracy to credibly challenge the official story. The burden of proof is on the authorities making the positive claim, or on a mainstream outlet or like the BBC, who are standing by their experts making a positive claim. So all we're doing is interrogating the forensic evidence. And by doing so, I think there's a lot of compelling questions. My problem, Tim, is I didn't see these compelling questions come up in the public inquiry. And I want to ask you about your, and Craig as well, what you thought were your initial reactions were of the inquiry. What were you expecting more? What was actually delivered? Tim, go ahead.
I think public inquiries of this nature are a public relations exercise. They're not designed to get to the truth. You could say that about the Hutton inquiry into David Kelly's death, again, around the WMD lie. So they're just designed to soap the official narrative. They try and answer questions, like this question about how the bottle ended up sealed in plastic. And they try and answer them because they don't like questions to remain unanswered. But, of course, it just ends up creating more questions, because then you say, well, why did the Russians take this extraordinarily lethal, potentially suicidal step of going to a public toilet and using it? It's completely absurd. So I didn't really expect anything from the inquiry in terms of answering any questions. And there was no, as Craig said, there was no cross-examination of any of the witnesses. Some of the witnesses came out with some really extraordinary statements, which were actually very interesting in terms of the narrative. And some of the witnesses were extremely credible. For example, there was a doctor who was the ICU doctor working in Salisbury District Hospital at the time that the Skripals were admitted. And he gave evidence to the inquiry. And he was clearly a very experienced and a very credible witness, speaking, you could tell, very honestly. And he gave testimony that just 4 days after Yulia was admitted to hospital, she woke up. And she had a tube in her mouth. She was on a ventilator. But because he was an experienced ICU doctor, he communicated with her by telling her to blink, and blink once for yes, twice for no. So by this time, Salisbury District Hospital had been told by Porton Down, which of course is the military laboratory, it's just coincidentally again, just a few miles up the road, had been told, they'd told the hospital that this early diagnosis of an opiate overdose, which is what they were working with, was in fact not right, and that they had been exposed to an organophosphate nerve agent. And so the doctor, Dr. Cockcroft, fully expected Yulia to be essentially brain damaged, dead, being kept alive just in a sort of mechanical way, but effectively dead. And so there's a process in hospitals where you try and reduce the sedation that a patient is on when they're on ventilation slowly. It's called a sedation hold. So you gradually reduce the amount of sedation that the patient is having to see if they can wake up, and you judge their neurological function, how healthy they are. So a different doctor had ordered this sedation hold on Yulia, but he was off the ward at the time when she did wake up. And so Dr. Cockcroft, who, as I said, was also the doctor who was first there when they were admitted, was called by the nurses who were sort of panicking. Oh, my God, you know, Yulia's waking up and she's intubated and she's, you know, danger of ripping out the drugs that were being given to her intravenously and so forth. And he said, I was gobsmacked. I couldn't believe how neurologically intact she was. I was able to communicate with her. And I said to her, but this is the key point, he managed to get her to say to her, were you sprayed? And she blinked yes. And he said, were you sprayed at home? And she blinked no. And he said, were you sprayed in the restaurant? And she blinked yes. And then, you know, her sedation was increased and she went back unconscious. And we never heard again about any further sedation holds, which should have been routine. He now discovered that Yulia was, in fact, almost completely well. But she was kept under sedation from that point onwards, as far as we know. And the inquiry simply ignored this testimony that Dr. Cockcroft reported about Yulia's blink interview. And the chair of the inquiry is called Lord Hughes. More or less said, well, she was just hallucinating because she was coming round from sedation. And, you know, the evidence doesn't support any of that. So we're just going to ignore that. There you go.
Yeah, and actually, to add to that, what Lord Hughes also said, Lord Hughes said it was hearsay evidence because the doctor was reporting what Yulia told him. It wasn't Yulia giving evidence direct. And it's very interesting that the Skripalds, who could have been, whether they are, if they are still alive, could have been produced to the inquiry to give evidence by video link, could have been done in a way so no one can tell where they are. The government did not produce them. They were not produced as witnesses to the inquiry, and you have to ask yourself why. And you referenced the Hutton inquiry into the death of Dr. David Kelly. I think that's right, the Chilcot inquiry. These things are always whitewashes. You know, these are the ways the establishment may say, oh, we did a few things wrong, lessons learned, but they never actually really get to the truth. They're not designed to get to the truth. They're the way the establishment sweeps up its dirty laundry. And it's always very telling, as with the Hutton inquiry, when they don't go through the normal inquest procedure, but instead go for an inquiry with their own hand-selected judge in charge who makes the decisions. And that's what's happened in this case.
Yeah, that's an important detail, Craig, to point out. And I'm glad you mentioned the David Kelly, because that's probably the closest incident I would put this in the frame with in terms of its political significance. And there is a tendency with the mainstream press and the government, when they do their inquiries, there's never a cover-up. It would always be a cock-up. So the point of the process is to say, mistakes were made, it's a cock-up, and the press can live with that. We need to appoint a new special person to, you know, close these gaps in our bureaucracy. We can't let this happen again. Never a cover-up, always a cock-up. That's a theme you'll see over and over. Craig, coincidentally, the one person who was doing tremendous damage to the official story on this was sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy at the time and had a very popular Twitter account. His name was Julian Assange. And he was doing such damage to the narrative on this, and it wasn't long before the calls came to cut off his internet. And I personally think it had a lot to do with this story, because Julian was tearing shreds off it, and it was getting noticeably embarrassing for the establishment. So that was more than a coincidence, in my opinion. And so, Tim, do you have anything you want to add on that?
I just want to add to that, that curiously enough, the solicitor to the inquiry, the Dawn Sturgis inquiry, was actually the same solicitor to the David and Kelly inquiry 20 years before. So kind of professional in handling these particularly, shall we say, tricky or controversial. He was also the solicitor to the inquiry into the 7/7 attacks. I would say the original hand-picked judge who was picked to chair the Dawn Sturgis inquiry was called Baroness Hallett. She's now the chair of the COVID inquiry, and Martin Smith is a solicitor to the COVID inquiry as well. So, you know, what are you going to do?
It's called a safe pair of hands, generally. So I want to ask both of you, where are the Skripals? Where is Sergei? Where is Ulia? Where do you think they are?
I think they're near Toronto. That's what my security service contacts tell me. You're absolutely right, and I should say I don't claim to know what happened in Salisbury. What happened is not... I do know for certain that the government story did not happen because there are a number of things in it which are simply wildly improbable or even impossible. It doesn't mean that I know what did happen. If you ask me to posit a theory, my theory is that somebody who is a double agent, and Skripal was a double agent for Russian security who leaked goods to, who leaked information to British security, somebody who's a double agent can easily become a triple agent and can decide to defect back again. It's even the case that intelligence agencies promote false defectors who pretend to defect, pretend to be double agents, join the other side, have close contact with the intelligence agency on that side, and then defect back again with the information they've got. I think that kind of spy game was probably in play. And I think those two Russians probably came to pick him up and take him back to Moscow. I think that's probably what happened, and that the British intervened to stop that happening. That, if you ask me for a counter theory, that's it. Can I prove it? No. Is it more likely than the government story? Yes, because if Putin wanted him dead, he'd be dead, and they'd have done it in a much more efficient way. So that's what I think probably came about. My expectation is that he's not actually a free man. I don't think they're living under new identities freely. I think the fact that they've never been seen again and can't be seen, even under circumstances where they could be given anonymity, like the public inquiry, where they could have appeared by video link, is deeply suspicious. And my contacts within the security service tell me they're being held near Toronto. But it's from a source I know who's told me other stuff which has proven to be true, but I can't prove it's true, because, again, in all these spy wars, you never know. I never know whether the contacts I have... And remember, I was in the Foreign Office for 22 years, so I know a lot of people in diplomacy and in the security services. But I can't tell sometimes I'm not being played. These spy games are complex, and they are full of lies. It's not abnormal for a story in the intelligence world to be a lie. It's actually... the normal means of operation. So what I'm telling you about the Skripals is not weird or unusual to intelligence professionals. But that's as much as I know.
And I'm going to throw one more at you, Craig. Sorry to do a double, but the Skripal story, do you see parallels with the Litvinenko? Polonium-210 poisoning. This was in the early 2000s. Alexander Litvinenko, a defector from Russian FSB, decamped in Britain, and this unlikely and improbable situation incident happens once again. Your thoughts?
Well, I'm sorry to say, given your introduction, I actually think Litvinenko was killed by the Russians. I think in his case, he was killed by the Russians. And I think if the Russians want to kill you, you're very likely to end up dead. I do think that Litvinenko was actually a Russian assassination. And I have contacts and I have reasons for believing that.
And it's also important, and Tim will explain maybe better than me, but Sergei Skripal wasn't just an ex-Russian agent who's like hanging out at the pleasure of Her Majesty and going to the bet shop and, you know, just living a nondescript life. He was working for private intelligence firm, if I'm not mistaken, Orbis. He was doing some work which is headed by the former head of British intelligence.
Former Russian desk. The head of the Russian desk.
Dearlov.
Okay, yeah.
Dearlov. And Christopher Steele of the infamous Steele dossier also was employed by this same firm. And Pablo Miller, I believe, working with them. So this is not just any group of people, is it? Very involved in a lot of things, including across the Atlantic, involved in, you know, the private sector of the intelligence industry. I don't know if either of you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, this is follows from what Craig was saying about a plausible alternative theory, which, again, you can't prove it, but there was, as Patrick says, a private intelligence firm, Orbis Business Intelligence. They called it Orbis. This is a little fun little thing. Orbis Business Intelligence, OBI, because they wanted it to sound like Obi-Wan, and they wanted to sound like the wise man from Star Wars. And that's just the sort of level of kind of maturity of thinking that is going into that. But anyhow, Pablo Miller was the man who recruited, he was an MI6 agent who recruited Sergei Skripal to sell secrets back to the British. And he was working with Christopher Steele, that is quite certain, as part of Orbis, around the time that Christopher Steele prepared this infamous, salacious dossier about then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016. And this was, apart from the fact that it was all, as Craig might say, bollocks, which has been pretty much shown to be the case quite recently, it was used by the Obama administration to essentially authorise bugging of candidate Trump's campaign, which is quite an extraordinary thing to have happened. In terms of democracy, you had a sitting president authorising the bugging of his political opponent's campaign for his own purposes on the basis of effectively fake intelligence that had been been purchased by the Hillary Clinton campaign, by the Democrats. And so this is a kind of explosive little cocktail of stuff that Sergei Skripal could be mixed up in if Orbis wants somebody to come in and give their, salacious dossier that authentic tone of Russian intelligence, which he would be very, very good at doing.
I'd like to add something really interesting to that, which is Pablo Miller was MI6's handler. When Skripal defected and was settled in Salisbury, Pablo Miller was the guy who looked after him, handled his defection, who interrogated him to get all the useful intelligence, and then was his minder, in effect. And Pablo Miller also lived in Salisbury. Now, Pablo Miller joined the army before he joined MI6. He joined a tank regiment, and he joined that regiment on the same day and at the same rank as the BBC's Mark Urban. Now, Mark Urban gave, when the Skripal story was first broken, it was first broken on the BBC News on a 7-minute special report by Mark Urban. And Mark Urban had been interviewing Sergei Skripal, apparently for a book, for the previous 2 years. He had frequently met Sergei Skripal. And in his report, he did not mention that he had ever met Sergei Skripal. Why did he withhold that information? What's Urban's relationship with... And Miller and Urban were in the same regiment for years, of the same rank, and were close friends. What's Urban's relationship with MI6's Skripal handler, and why did the BBC omit that in giving us all those reports? And it was Mark Urban who did nearly all the BBC stuff on the Skripals. And that's how it works in terms of putting out a lying propaganda line and establishing the media line that's fed to you. And I'm willing to bet most of you didn't know any of that. But you should. This is the kind of information that ought to be available to citizens in a democracy to allow you to evaluate who is feeding you these lines and why they are doing it.
And also, it's the WMD, it is so emotive, and it's been used on different situations by our governments to justify or to advance or to accelerate policy, war. You know, there was immediate diplomatic proscriptions, wasn't there, and the expulsions of diplomats. I mean, there was immediate policy ramifications, escalation between U.S., Britain, and Russia.
I think 136 diplomats were expelled. The U.S. Expelled the largest number of diplomats. They expelled 60 diplomats as a direct result of the Salisbury poisoning. And they closed down the Russian embassy in Seattle as a consequence. And there's just a little detail about this, which is, as I mentioned, no ducks were killed after touching, you know, the Skripals had deadly nerve agent on their hands. They go to Salisbury and they feed ducks with local boys with pieces of bread. And they give the bread to local boys. And in fact, one of the boys was reported to have eaten a piece of the bread that had been given by the poisoned hands of the Skripals. But it didn't happen. You know, the ducks were fine, the boys were fine. The boys were tested in hospital. Everyone was absolutely fine. However, over in the Atlantic, the then deputy, later to be head of CIA, Gina Haspel, who has an extremely dark history and a close relationship with Christopher Steele at the time that he was head of the Russia desk in the UK, told Donald Trump, or so it would seem from a report to the New York Times, told Donald Trump that ducks had been killed and boys had been injured, and showed him photographs because the New York Times article says, you know, she knows how to sort of play on President Trump's emotions. And so she showed him some pictures of dead ducks. And Donald Trump was very upset by the pictures of the dead ducks and the injured children. And so he ordered 60 diplomats to be expelled and closed down the embassy in Seattle. And then, you know, a few weeks later, the NYT quietly withdrew that, and no, we made a mistake, and that didn't happen. He was just shown some photographs of what could have happened. Why? Anyway, and, you know, they weren't specific pictures to what happened in Salisbury, but there you go. The damage had been done. The diplomats had been expelled, and we were on the path towards war.
Yeah, and a lot of this creates the grounding for the current acrimony between East and West. These are really important events. The other thing I want to ask you is about the forensic. Sergei Skripal's BMW car and the roof of the apartment and the table they at, the furniture in ZZ's, all of this stuff was, what, removed? Did they bury the car? I mean, and they removed the roof from the flat and then just buried that as well? Like, what happened?
They buried 24 emergency vehicles. They buried 8 ambulances. It was in a sort of toxic dump in Gloucestershire, which is a special place where you put particularly toxic and deadly material. They buried all these 24 emergency vehicles there, and obviously you can't go there because it's a toxic dump. And as you say, in the case of the Skripal house, for some reason the roof was removed. It's one thing that Craig mentions actually in his article Pure. It's one of the points he makes. The roof was removed, but how can how does some Novichok deadly poison get from the front door of the house up to the roof? Anyway, they replaced the roof, and the house has now actually been sold as being lived in. Meanwhile, over in Amesbury, where Charlie Rowley, 4 months after the events, spilled the Novichok in his hands and so on, that entire building was demolished. It was almost brand new social housing that had been built for people like Charlie Rowley, who was, of course, you know, a recovering, shall we say, addict. And they bulldozed it. They demolished it completely. All evidence has gone.
Just to add to that, I was talking my article called Pure, 10 Things I Don't Believe. The reason it's called Pure is that the British government took, allegedly, a swab of the Novichok from the door handle and sent it to the OPCW, to the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons, for analysis. And their analysis came back saying that it was 100% pure. The interesting thing is, it had been on a dirty door handle, and it had been raining on it for 2 days before the swab was taken. And rain is not pure water, as you know. Acid rain is famous. Rain contains contaminants. it cannot have been 100% pure and have been taken from the Skripal's door handle. That had come straight off a laboratory, which I very much suggest to you was Porton Down.
Now, I want to take some questions from the audience. Let's try to avoid any long diatribes. If we want to debate about the Ukraine war, I'd be happy to have that debate off stage with anybody. Maybe we'll do another session. But I want to first I want to see a show of hands of anybody that came in here today, based on what you've seen, that you are now looking at this issue differently as a result of what's been presented. Show of hands. That's impressive, and that's why we're doing this. We were really just presenting, minimal theorizing, and just really interrogating the evidence, interrogating the narrative and the official story, and also to understand the implications of it, that it's not just the Skripal story. There's a big global geopolitical significance to this story. It really amplifies out, so... If we get some help on the Q&A, if someone can help with the microphone, we'll go first to this gentleman in the glasses.
We've lived in Salisbury nearly 20 years, so it's really quite personal for us. We live through it. I've got one comment and one question. My comment is about, Craig, you used the word laughable. For us, it wasn't laughable, regardless of what evidence you say and things like that. So I would just ask you to be aware of that fact that people live through it and it wasn't laughable, no matter what evidence you saw. So if you could just be a little bit more careful, please, as to... what words you use in order for that, because it was so very personal for us. So that's just one thing. In terms of the bigger picture, for us, again, it was a bigger picture, because not only was various houses sort of taken away, but Zizi's was literally obliterated inside. The old Bishop Mill was literally obliterated upside. We were coned off, we were sectioned off, we were... You know, there was a lot of fear for a long time, but also it affected the economy for a long time. And I get their various theories. Why on earth would the government allow that to happen to Salisbury for whatever agenda they had? Because for us, it was far much more than what you're describing, far much more. And I'm just curious to know why you think the government would have let that happen to Salisbury, that utter devastation, that chaos, that fear for that.
Well, that's a very fair question. And I would reply with another question or another statement, which is to say, I'm curious about why you think the government cares about ordinary people, the ordinary people of a government's priority. Because they don't. This has produced a huge bonus for the weapons industry. It's produced a narrative they can use to pump up the budgets for security services. It's produced fear in the population. And the government uses fear in order to control people. We don't live in a country where we have people in power whose desire is to serve and care about the ordinary public. Unfortunately, I wish we did, but we don't. And I apologise. I do apologise. I meant with what I said about Don Sturgis to say that I hope that because the official narrative is laughable, people don't think that I take the consequences of what happened to people as laughable, because I don't at all. And I 100% accept what you say. But in terms of geostrategic manoeuvring, in terms of demonization of Russia, in terms of increasing the NATO budget, in terms of everything the government is trying to do, that to them is much more important than you are as a citizen of Salisbury. And that's simply the truth. And the answer is that, yes, they happily do those things to people. They they are, we are not governed by good people. And I think that, if I can revert just very, very briefly to Gaza, most people in the country are horrified by what's happening to the people in Gaza. Most people want the government to do something about it. But the government's not doing something about it because the government doesn't care about what most people think. The government cares about the people who pay the members of the government. And sadly... sadly, that's the world we live in. So, what was done to you was terrible. What was done to Salisbury was terrible. And it's based on a lie. Because the consequences were terrible doesn't make the lie it was based upon the truth.
Thank you so much for your talk. I just wanted to ask, I've no doubt that what you said about us being placed on a war footing is correct and it's very frightening. I just wanted you to talk a bit more about who is doing that, why they're doing that, and what you predict the direction that we go in will be because of it.
You were talking about the fear, why people are using fear in a more general sense. Sorry. I couldn't possibly answer any better to that point than Craig has done, except to observe that fear is the classic way by which governments increase their authoritarian policies. All everything we're seeing at the moment from the government is to do with weaponizing fear, turning it into legislation, and using it to suppress just open debate, effectively, in my opinion.
I think one thing that you guys, probably a lot of people at this festival or in this tent, will be familiar with, the academic answer to what you're talking about would be, the closest thing I would initially go to would be Noam Chomsky. Chomsky and Herman's manufacturing consent. So that's effectively what's going on. It's the manufacturing of public consent. Because every policy needs some kind of buy-in from the public, some kind of consent. How do you manufacture that consent? Through propaganda, through, some might call it, false flag attacks. This is not, these aren't wild conspiracy theories. There's many documented examples of this right across the world for as long as history has existed. So manufacturing consent, that's the starting point, and then I think that's something I think a lot of people could relate to. Craig.
Sorry, Salisbury stealing the mic here, but obviously it's left us with a lot of questions, and thank you. So it's a double-edged question. So how reliable was Charlie Rowley as a witness? How credible was he as a witness? The other thing is that the method of delivery, if you're going to spray something as lethal as Novichok, you wouldn't use an aerosol spray because that would be a huge risk on yourself. And also, the nozzle on the bottle didn't lend itself to being a kind of aerosol-type spray. So... Why was that configuration used?
So, to the first question about Charlie Rowley, I mean, that's a very important point, because Charlie Rowley's testimony, that's the sole source of the narrative. It's the sole source of the narrative, you know, that he found it in a bin, although, as I hopefully showed you, he didn't really remember finding it in a bin, and that Dawn Sturges sprayed it on her wrists, and then, obviously, she died. He's the single source for that. And he did not appear before the Dawn Sturges inquiry. He was said to be too ill to appear. And so as a result of that, the Sturges inquiry was reduced to essentially speculating about testimony that he gave to police at the time of the... after recovering from hospital. He gave that interview to ITV News against the wishes of the authorities, of course, because he was paid to do it. And in the testimony that they go over in the inquiry, at one point the policeman says to him, "Did you take heroin that day that you found the bottle, Charlie?" And he says, "Well, yes, I probably did take heroin that day, yes." And he says, "And did you have a drink, you know, that day where you found the bottle, Charlie?" And he said, "Well, yeah, I probably did have a drink." And the policeman says, "Well, what, you know, how much do you think you had to drink?" And he says, "Well, about 3 bottles of wine and about 8 bottles of 9% beer." And we didn't remember getting back home to Amesbury that night. All I know is we woke up in Amesbury flat the next day, so we must have taken the bus there. So that's the quality of his testimony and the reliability of it. And yet the inquiry has to take that as official testimony. It had to accept it because, as I said, it's the sole foundation of this narrative. And it's terribly unreliable testimony, as you suggest. Now, with the bottle, as you say, it's totally insane to think that you would use an aerosol spray, an aerosol, you know, atomizing a deadly nerve agent without protective gear, as Craig was saying, is suicide. If we really are talking about a military-grade nerve agent, which is, of course, the phrase we heard all the time, military-grade nerve agent used on UK soil. So, in fact, it was said to be an oily... It was smeared on the door handle again. But then that raises the problem of, well, then how did Dawn spray it? Did she spray it on herself or not? Did she? You know, I think the word spray is in fact a propagandized word in itself in this context, because we can all envisage that quite easily. We can all think of that quite simply. Yes, spray. You know, rub your wrists together. It feels like an action that we can all relate to or that we can understand. But exactly as you said, the realities of doing that with a nerve agent are quite different. And then finally, to the third point about that nozzle. I mean, I haven't got the... I wish I had the laptop up again, but the nozzle was identical to a nozzle from a throat spray called Teva Jocks. Teva being an Israeli... a large Israeli huge big pharma company. And this long nozzle appeared to have just been taken from that and then put on the body, if you like, of a Nina Ritchie bottle. So all I can say about that is it looked like a sort of badly jimmied together bit of evidence after the event, and none of it makes sense, which, again, the fact it doesn't make sense, it really is in no way an insult to anybody. I'm sorry, I do take your point. I do not wish to downplay anything in terms of the impact of people's lives. But it is, unfortunately, an absurd story of itself in terms of its nature.
And, Tim, where can people find you? You publish some good articles that are extensive, that are available. You can pop them up on your phone right now. Where can they find your big pieces on this?
So, yeah, thank you. There's a piece on UK Column where you'll see Patrick Monday, Wednesday and Friday called The Day of the Skripal, which is a timeline. But most of my stuff is on a website called propagandainfocus.com, which is run by Piers Robertson, the academic, who's been here in the Ribble Tent in the past. And he's published almost all my stuff. I did a three-part analysis of the Dawn Sturgis inquiry called 12 points, inspired by Craig's work, in fact, 12 points from the Dawn Sturgis inquiry. And I go through all that stuff I said there.
Thanks. So, yeah, ukcolumn.org. Propaganda in Focus is a very important website run by a team of academics who basically work with whistleblowers from the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and debunked the so-called chemical weapons attacks in Syria, at least one of them, which was the Duma alleged attack in, I believe it was April 2018, and thoroughly debunked, and including ex-director levels of the OPCW that testified on the WikiLeaks also reported on this as well. This is very, very high-level, very credible work, and I would put Tim's work in that league. And we had another person at the Rebel Tent 4 years ago named Robert Stewart. Was Robert here? But Saving Syria's Children was a BBC documentary that was fabricated. And it was broadcast right before the Syrian war vote in August of 2013. And that was also thoroughly exposed as a fabrication. And that was an independent person who took that one issue and he worked on it for like 5 years. And just a member of the public, but he made such a huge impact because it was so high profile and so pivotal in shaping the narrative at that time. And I think Tim has also done this as a person from the public who's just had questions and has really drilled in and has not let go of this story. And I would rate his work on this topic as really the best out there. So let's give a round of applause for Craig and Tim.
And a big round of applause for yourselves, because for sitting here, listening to this, taking this in, and for having your own questions, those of you who participated in the Q&A, this is a very difficult material. So I think you guys deserve a round of applause yourselves for participating.